From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 2007 when a native of Buffalo decided to leave a New York City hedge fund. And that would qualify as a strange decision for a man who had spent years working toward hedge fund success, doing what you might call the grunt work after undergrad, getting his MBA, then working through the New York maze of competitive finance. Why walk away? David Ryder was not just leaving a hedge fund for another job in finance, maybe at another firm or in another city. He was leaving to enter the seminary. He'd come to feel that the quality of life was not only defined by earnings potential. And maybe, he might say, his soul was suffering. And today, David Ryder is the planting pastor for Flower City Church in Rochester. And I've asked him to come in and share his story about one of the more dramatic career changes I have heard of. So let me introduce Minister David Ryder. It's nice to see you.
Nice to see you. Thanks for having me.
Well, I, you know, you can tell the story better than I can, but in short here, I want to establish something right off the bat. You're not here condemning all of the world of finance. You're not condemning people who work for hedge funds or Wall Street. In fact, you said that in many ways you did enjoy that work.
I loved the work and met a lot of great people in it. So absolutely not doing any of that at all. And when people ask the question, that's often one of the assumptions they make is, oh, you must have hated it, the grind, all those type A personalities just competing with one another. And really, I enjoyed the environment. There was a lot of camaraderie on a trading desk, a lot of people engaging in analytical work and doing things of that nature, and it was quite fun. So it's nothing like that at all.
People probably want you to bash Wall Street and hedge funds.
That's popular these days.
Yeah, sure. But at the same time, you've told me you did feel that at the end of you would get to these points where you feel like ultimately you were making a lot of money, but there wasn't a lot that was coming with it. Yes.
I don't know if I'd quite go so far as there's not a lot coming with it. There are some specific things. And when people, I think when Christians talk about call and a minister talks about being called to ministry, if somebody's a lifelong Christian that spent their time in the church, instantly that makes sense. For people who aren't Christians, they say they have no idea what you're talking about. What does that mean? And so discerning a call to seminary for me, I would say for somebody who isn't a lifelong Christian and doesn't know what that language means, it's kind of almost like a conscience or kind of some internal sense of where you are and what you're doing and what the worth of that is. And so it's not like an auditory illusion. I didn't have a big booming voice come
you're
out of the sky.
You're on this hill and this light
right.
shone down.
You know, the famous story of Paul on the road to Damascus and he gets knocked off his horse. There's nothing like that at all, but just kind of a gnawing that there would be something else. And I think I knew that even when I arrived in New York, but I didn't know that the something else would be seminary. I don't think I knew that I was going to walk away from the hedge fund to do something so completely unrelated. And that was just kind of a gnawing sense based on what was enduring is, I think, the word that we used earlier. Is what was fleeting and what was enduring, and that's really, I think, was the hook that kept gnawing at me, kept working at me through my time there.
You were making a lot of money, weren't you?
I was. You're not going to ask me how much.
I'm not going to ask you how much, but let's just say you were doing pretty well, huh?
I was doing well. Yeah.
And a small firm, so it's not the kind of firm. David could mention the name of the firm, and none of us would have ever heard of it. But
yeah. It's called Kellner DeLeo for anybody who does.
Okay.
But yeah,
small firm.
It's, yeah.
And you were walking away at a time where you were not only doing well, but you were in position to do very, very well, right?
That's correct. So you hear the stories of people in their early 30s making partner and becoming portfolio manager. You hear the stories because they're not that common, right? I spent 3.5 years as an analyst, and at the end of 2004, beginning of 2005, they made me a partner, gave me a portfolio to manage. And it was at that time, I think, that George, who had started the firm, at first started talking to me about this idea of when he would step down. Perhaps even taking over the firm. And so I had known that even in the 2.5 years that I was running the money and running the portfolio, that there was this possibility looming out there. And he mentioned that when I told him I was leaving to go to seminary. He said, you know, for him, this was very disappointing to hear because he had that in mind and had that vision for the firm. But, you know, to his credit, and I think very highly of him for a lot of reasons that people don't associate with Wall Street, of loyalty and just creating a good work environment, caring about his people, not just churning and burning. But a lot of respect for him. But he said, listen, I'm disappointed, but if you're called to go to seminary, you go to seminary. You didn't wonder why or try to persuade me or offer more money or do anything that would be unhelpful and unrelated. It was great.
But you knew what you were walking away from.
I did. In fact, so then I had to tell the analysts who worked for me, and I pulled them into the room right after I got out of the meeting with George. Obviously, I told him first. And I'll never forget, because, you know, there's a lot of, nothing's out of bounds there. And in fact, when I went to seminary, one of the first things I said in keeping in touch with one of the other portfolio managers was, every once in a while, I forget I'm no longer surrounded by people with no feelings. she said, oh, great, you're making friends. but so nothing's out of bounds there. So I told them I was leaving, and the one analyst just paused and he's looking at me. And I said, you know, what's going on? He said, I'm just waiting to hear if you're going to tell us you're joking. Oh. And so, you know, I wasn't.
And you said George was kind enough to recognize the value in this decision right away. But I'm wondering if others in your life, did anybody say, are you sure? I mean, you think about all the years you spent putting in, and you say for you in many ways it was enjoyable. It didn't always feel like the grind and the burnout that you do here, and I'm sure you saw that. I mean, you were sort of in that world, but it's still a lot of time and effort and investment, and you are setting yourself up financially to do whatever you want in this world. Did anybody say, hold on, David, are you sure?
That's an interesting question, and I can't recall a time. There's nothing I can pull up that says, yeah, I have this one memory of somebody doing that. I will say a part of it was that I had involved people very close to me in the discernment process throughout. I didn't just wake up one morning and say, hey, guess what? I'm walking away. This was a process that took years of deciding and discerning. And so, you know, I always say my wife got the rawest deal of all, because she was a, you know, living on the Upper East Side and had a husband working at a hedge fund and didn't work and did whatever she wanted and had all this luxury. And now she's like a minister's wife. How'd you sign up for that? I'm sorry, honey. you know, so she was involved from the beginning. Close friends were involved from the beginning. And so people who knew me most, more were along the lines of affirming and saying, I see this. I see. And so that was part of my discernment, was people who really knew me saying, I can see why you'd feel that call to seminary. I was a Christian my whole life. So it wasn't like that was a new conversion where I suddenly moved in a completely different direction with my belief system or anything like that.
All right, we're going to work backwards in a second and kind of talk about his upbringing and kind of what led to this point. But before we do that, we've got a listener in Spencerport. Keith just wants to know a little bit more about the work you did. Go ahead, Keith.
Evan, thank you. What type of designation did you have when you were working in the financial industry? Were you a CFP, a CFP, a CFA, and did you function as a fiduciary?
Yes, I had my CFA designation. I started as an analyst, when I was a portfolio manager, I had discretionary control over the investment. So I was picking stocks. I was deciding how much to allocate to each position. I had control. I was using options. So that's kind of the nature of the work. And specifically, the hedge fund that I was working for focused on merger arb. And so if you know what that is, merger arbitrage is when two companies agree to merge, there's a spread between the stated price of what that deal is going to be and what it actually is at the risk of it not closing. So we would bet on that spread. And then I was expanded the scope, and the portfolio I was ultimately running had to do with special situations. So any company that wasn't in a steady state.
Did you, again, I tuned in midstream on this. Did you ever have any guilt that you might have done something just to make the money? I mean, I saw the movie The Big Short, and I understood what it was about going into it. And you can make money off of somebody else's misery, and I think that might weigh heavily on some people. Did any of that play into your life?
I don't know that I ever felt as though I can't think of a position where I was making money off of somebody else's misery, except for perhaps some top executives that have been fired. So when Carly Fiorina was fired from Hewlett-Packard, I was buying Hewlett-Packard stock aggressively that morning because I felt the company had been mismanaged. And so I guess in some ways, maybe I felt like I was profiting off of her misery in that moment. But in terms of, you know, that's not real misery, right? She's doing just fine. But in terms of other kind of misery, you know, I guess one time I can think of was... I was on the desk very early on, and I just started 3 months earlier when September 11th happened, and they ended up closing the market that day, and that was a good decision. They closed it for the week. I don't know if you remember or not, but one of the things that was going on in the pre-market activity and especially in the time where there was confusion at first until the second plane hit. Not everyone knew what was happening. And in those moments of confusion, there were orders still being placed, pre-market activity and pre-market trades happening. And as soon as we realized what was going on for our firm, I will say the chief investment officer said, cancel everything. We're not betting on this. We're not participating. If they're stupid enough to open up this market, we will not participate. And so there was a real ethic going on where I was that I don't think people associate with the industry. I don't want to say it's not in other places in the industry, because I think it probably is more so than people realize. But there was something going on of, we're not going to bet on certain things. Some things are not worth profiting on. And so that happened, like I said, 3 months into my tenure there, and that kind of shaped how we viewed what we would and wouldn't do.
Thank you.
Sure.
Keith, thanks for the phone call. I think good questions. And if you're just joining us, David Ryder is Minister David Ryder, planning pastor for Flower City Church in Rochester. We're going to talk about what that means and what's going on with the church as we go throughout the hour here. I don't want to pin you down on something, but let me just follow up to Keith's question in a couple of ways, David.
Sure.
You did mention before the hour began that, you know, you talk about mergers and ARB and these deals that you would work on. And there was a lot of effort and information to learn to soak up and use. And the deal would happen and you'd make a lot of money. But then that information was sort of, at that point, it was sort of spent. It wasn't as useful to you going forward. And the question was like, well, what was left? What did I really get out of that? I mean, can you tell me a little bit more about that feeling?
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe one way to get at this is after my first year, the firm didn't do well the first show is there. And, you know, I was new to the industry, and one of the guys that had been around for a while took me out for, we went out to a bar across the street and had a glass of bourbon, and he looked at me and he just said, you know, this is the worst time for us in this industry, because what we do, it's not like painting a fence. You can't look back at the end of the day and say, hey, this is what I built, this is what I did, this is what I worked on, this is what's there. We just bet, and we either make money or we don't. And so in a year when we don't make money, we just look back at the year and felt like we just wasted an entire year and didn't accomplish anything. And so that's a way of thinking of, what are you really doing here? You're just kind of generating trades and moving pieces of paper around. And so that carried forward for me in a way that it didn't necessarily for him, which was, even in a year we do make money, that's all we've done. We haven't really, I didn't feel like I was doing something enduring. And this is where we want to be careful, because I do value a lot of the people I worked with, people who invest and are contributing towards people's retirement systems and enabling them to retire through the investments. I mean, the whole industry exists so that good ideas can be brought to market and can go to business. And so there's good things happening. But for me, when I looked at it, exactly what you said, even if a deal went the right way and we made a bunch of money, it was then a bunch of knowledge for me that was discarded. It was kind of short-term knowledge. It was fleeting, ephemeral. We didn't have something that was enduring. And I don't feel that way in currently what I'm doing. I feel like what's doing now, the work we're doing now is enduring. Whether it's studying a scripture passage for preaching, the sermon might be over, but that knowledge, that whatever wisdom has come from that, whatever new revelations I've learned about myself, about the world, about others, about how to serve, is enduring and applicable in a number of ways going forward that continues. And so there's this kind of enduring nature versus a fleeting nature of how you're spending your time and where you're directing your energy and resources.
And so you end up leaving that industry in 2007, right when the crash is starting. And
it was too bad.
And I saw you smile a little bit when Keith mentioned The Big Short. And it certainly, that was a subject that we discussed on this program on a previous episode, where we just talked about, sometimes you can oversimplify. Sometimes there's good value to be learned out of entertainment products like that. But I do think it's important to establish whether you think, even if it's not the norm or the majority, if you do feel that Wall Street occasionally isn't just helping people's retirement systems and helping people retire earlier, that there is a creation of instruments for the purpose of short-term gain that really does imperil the system, that is imperiling 401ks and has the potential to hurt people based on avarice.
Yeah, so I'll set the movie aside for a second and go to the book, because Michael Lewis is an excellent writer and I think he nails it. He actually nails it in Liar's Poker, which I think is his first book.
And I think that goes back to the 80s.
Yeah, yeah. And what he saw was that the industry changed when these banks became public, and especially now that they're too big to fail, or deemed too big to fail. I don't know if they really should be, but they're deemed too big to fail. What you're doing is you have a lot of incentive built in to to take chances and to take undue risk because you don't have, you're not going to pay the price if it all goes down. And if it was a tightly held partnership, and this is what he talked about with Salomon Brothers and his history there. In a tightly held partnership, the partners would never let you be leveraged 50 to 1. I mean, I think of long-term capital management, even going before The Big Short. It never would have allowed that kind of leverage because they would have gone bankrupt. Whereas if it's shareholders that are just going to lose a bunch of money, whoever they are, or the government's going to bail them out so even they don't get hammered that badly, then you have a situation where there's all upside. If I can make, and typically in a hedge fund, you keep 20% of your profit. So if I can keep 20% of every dollar I make, and I'm going to lose $0 for every dollar I lose, of course I'm going to take on a ton of risk. And so it's structured in such a way to encourage that kind of behavior. But I think generally the people that are working there are not immoral, but perhaps amoral. You know, they're not looking for how can I screw somebody? Sorry if I'm...
That's okay.
They're looking for I don't care what the damage is. It's my job. And this is where my fiduciary, your fiduciary responsibility is to your shareholder. And your shareholder, that's where ethics and morals can kind of collide, where you're saying, well, I'm obligated to make as much money as I can for these shareholders because that's what they've signed, or for my investors, because that's what they've signed on for me to do. I can't care about this other stuff unless it's explicit in my investment agreement with the people who've invested their money with me.
You strike me as the kind of person who that's not really okay with, though.
No, it's not.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, that's what I wanted to get to.
Yeah.
And when we talk about what you walked away from, I think it's also valuable to talk about what you think maybe ought to change. And, you know, that's just one of the things. So David Ryder, my guest, he is the planning pastor for Flower City Church in Rochester, walked away from that hedge fund job in 2007. As you were walking away, what did you make of what you were seeing unfold as things were really, really going down? And I mean, did you know going in that some of these instruments, the credit default swaps and everything that was sort of created that helped create this Jenga that was falling apart, were you aware of that?
So as far as credit default swaps go, we didn't have positions in those specifically. Part of that is because the size of our firm, we didn't have the ability to create.
But were you aware that they were out there?
And we were trying to... And that one of the things that The Big Short did poorly, I think, in articulating this is that it could leave you with the impression that only these handful of guys knew what was happening. And that's not really true. A lot of people knew what was happening, and it was out there in literature what was happening. These handful of guys found a way to profit off of what was happening. We were looking at shorting home builders. We were looking at puts on home building stock, but you couldn't get a locate. You couldn't borrow shares to short because everybody was looking to short home builders because everybody knew that there was this bubble on Wall Street. So it wasn't.
I guess by 2007.
And even in
2006.
In 2006.
Okay.
They caught it earlier and they found an instrument to do it. And they it's all hats off to them. But I just, when you can't borrow any stocks in an industry to short, you know that a lot of people know that something's wrong,
okay,
right? So the extent of it and how to profit from it was absolutely to their credit. But
sure,
it was known.
Okay. And then so the final point then before we kind of go back through your own history, and we're going to talk about Flower City Church and the work that you are very clearly excited about to share now is, you know, you walked away from a hedge fund, you were making a great living, and you were set up to make an even greater living just in terms of the money that you were making. But you did not have that going to bed at night ethical dilemma that others may have if they had your sort of moral code, because you're the kind of person who said after 9/11, we're not betting on this. We're not going to try to profit off this. You were the kind of person who didn't like the moral hazard or the problems that came with profiting 20% but losing zero. You know, so you were maybe not an outlier, but you weren't in that category of people. I guess what I'm learning from you is there is a way to look at Wall Street and to look at our financial system apart from the cartoons that have been created, either, you know, these rich bankers with the bag of money, you know, in the world, and, you know, they're laughing as it burns, or, you know, these geniuses, and, you know, it doesn't have to be that way. That people can make a lot of money without jeopardizing and hurting a lot of people. That can and does happen.
I think that can and does happen. I think our financial markets function the way they do so that, like I said, so ideas, this is how credit comes, so somebody with an idea for a business can get funded out. Businesses can grow out of this. I do think the idea of banks being publicly held, and especially these trading vehicles being publicly held, is one of the things that Michael Lewis just nails, and that's one of the root problems. But that doesn't mean it has to be that way.
Yeah. You want Glass-Steagall back?
I mean, it probably wasn't a bad thing. I don't think that's the solution the way people think it is, but it would probably help some people that have just their regular bank accounts, and it would probably also help allow banks to fail, because you're not going to hurt the people that have their savings. I mean, FDIC protects some of that too, so I don't know. I don't know if Glass-Steagall's really the answer, but...
Okay. Listeners, if you want to dive a little deeper into Glass-Steagall, we did that a couple of weeks ago on this program, and the conclusion from the panelists was that it may be a tool, but it's been oversimplified by some political leaders that and by the way, on both sides, both the Republican and Democratic Party platforms this year call for reinstituting Glass-Steagall, but it shouldn't be viewed as sort of the magic bullet.
Yeah, it's not going to solve all the problems. Right. So when you ask it, it's like, sure, it might be helpful, but I don't think that's... Oh, that'll do it.
Yeah. Sure. And so if you're going, what's Glass-Steagall? That's why you should be subscribing to the Connections podcast. You can go back and find out on your next jog or longer drive. David Ryder, planting pastor for Flower City Church in Rochester, grew up in, well, I said Buffalo, but where in Buffalo?
West Seneca, just outside, yeah.
West Seneca. Grew up going to church?
Yep.
And so were you, what kind of, you know, sort of a strange question, but what kind of Christian were you growing up? Let's put it that. Is that a fair question?
It is. I don't know how to answer it because I was going to snarkily say a nominal one.
were you a CNE or a CEO? Christian?
No. Okay. We were regular attendees on Sunday. Right. I think that growing up and in my one of the things that you could say in my early life with Christianity is that it could be fairly compartmentalized. And I think that's how people are now. And one of the things with Flower City Church, as we turn to that, is to try to address people as whole people. And so you don't just have your friends from church, your friends from work, your friends from wherever. And I think in our virtual world, we're able to do that in ways where we can just connect with this club or this group on whether it's social media settings or whether it's even just compartmentalizing our face-to-face interactions. And so, you know, what kind of Christian was I? I think the church was part of my life. We were regular Sunday morning worshipers. Did I see and did I feel in my life that decisions were generally shaped by and heavily influenced by what I was learning there? Sometimes, but maybe not holistically.
Okay. And even when you started to pursue the career in finance that you did, again, Christianity was part of your life. It wasn't something that came to you in a bolt of lightning. So it was there in the background or the foreground. Mm-hmm. But when was the first time you thought, I could see myself in the seminary?
Oh, probably 2002, 2003, somewhere in that neighborhood. My best friend from West Seneca growing up moved to New York City about a year after I did. And he and his wife... And my wife and I, we the four of us sat down and started doing a Bible study together, and then some other friends joined us. The next thing I know, we're kind of meeting on a Starbucks on Wall Street on Monday nights, and there's eight of us sitting around going through a Bible study. And I think through that, and that's probably why some of the people closest to me could start to see this kind of teaching and exploring Scripture and learning from it. And I was definitely leading that, even though I was a layperson, even though we were all going to different churches, or in some cases, some of the people there weren't really going on a Sunday. And I think that's also where I started to reevaluate. I mean, people knock. One of the knocks on the church is hypocrisy. And I think one of the things we talked about is this kind of sense that there's an incongruity, right, between what I profess to believe and where I looked at my weekly calendar, say. What does your calendar look like? Where do you forget about money for a second. Just where do you spend your time and your energy and other resources? And then in addition, where do you spend your money? And looking at that and saying, you know, is this really the thing? Are these the things that are most important to me?
Am I living my values?
And I think it was in that kind of phase where that started to say, well, what would it look like for me to live into these values? And if people are starting to see these gifts, this skill set of being able to teach and explore Scripture, and that I'm not just kind of a finance analytical type person, that there's these other, perhaps this other untapped skill set. What does that mean, and how do I live into that responsibly?
So maybe 2002, 2003, it entered your mind, but it took some time to get there. And what did your wife say about it when it got more serious?
She's listening. I have to be careful, Evan. Yeah, I think that her initial response was the same as, and this is interesting because it was the same as a. When we'd go through all the personality tests in seminary, when we first arrived, one of the people that had psychiatric training and evaluated these scores said, you know, your personality, I'm not sure if you can really be there for somebody if you think that, that what they're suffering through is irrational? You know, if it doesn't make sense to you, are you really going to be able to walk with them in it?
What a good question.
And because of that, that analytic rationality. And now my wife actually says, well, there's hedge fund Dave, and then there's Pastor Dave. And they're really two different personas. And it kind of depends. You know, I have a group of guys that we meet on my porch for growler night on Wednesday nights. And so after a couple of beers, sometimes hedge fund Dave still comes out. He's not dead yet. And that just kind of grew, and something that had to grow. And I think that was her first concern. She said, I can see the preaching, I can see the teaching. But what about the pastoral care, especially when someone comes to you with a problem and you look at it and you say, you know, if somebody's had a real problem, you can be empathetic and you could be there. If it becomes a problem and you look at them and say, you know, this isn't that big of a deal. Why are you making a big deal about it? And that fear, I mean, I wouldn't literally say those words, but will I be able to walk with them?
Do you have to learn, this is a strange construction, do you have to learn empathy, or do you have to broaden your capacity to consider other problems that you may initially not fully grasp?
Yeah, I mean, I don't. That's a big question. Do you have to learn empathy? I mean, I think yes. I think we can see in children how they have to learn and grow into through not head knowledge but through modeling of how to empathize.
I'm not sure that's the right way to say it. But anyway, what I'm saying is, if your wife is concerned that, you know, when people come to you, if you don't get the problem, then you can't really receive it and work with it.
Right.
Do you have to learn to consider other perspectives a little more, you know, openly? And, you know, is that part of the process?
I think so, for sure. And that goes back to that kind of joke about no longer being surrounded by people who have no feelings. The filter has to come on differently. And yeah, I mean, I think I was empathetic to problems I understood. Like, you know, if somebody has somebody close to them die, you can be empathetic and you can walk with them. And you understand right away that's a big problem. It's more the petty stuff that I would view as petty stuff that somebody else is a big deal to them. Hey, this is a big deal to this person. And I've got to be with them in that it's a big deal to them, even if I don't quite understand why it's a big deal. And that had to be learned.
I was thinking about that this week in a parenting moment of frustration when my, you know, 4.5-year-old is complaining about something that was, you know, I thought was silly.
I don't know anything about frustration in parenting.
No?
You have the perfect child.
How old?
He's 9. I'm kidding.
Okay. So, you know, any parent has gone through these moments of frustration where you think this is a problem. And, you know, we had just talked about the boy in Syria and the picture, and I thought, is 4? They say empathy starts at 6. Should I show them the picture? And I say, this could be you. Like, think about how good you have it. And you have these moments where you want to diminish someone's concern. But then I thought, you know what? Look, even at 4.5, he has a limited perspective of the world. But whatever problem he sees, he's seeing it for a reason. And I'm not going to shame the problem out of him.
Right.
I'm going to try to understand it. And I find myself having a little bit more success as a parent when I pull myself back from that frustration and say, okay, your feelings are valid, even if I think you're missing a point, but let's talk through it.
Oh, I think becoming a father is one of the things that radically altered my perception of God. Just a deeper understanding of just on so many levels of the relationship of kind of an inequitable relationship and yet still a deeply loving relationship of, you know, when I study the story of David in First and Second Samuel, and we go through how can this man who was a warrior king, who was, you know, not always great, there's that story with Bathsheba, how can this be a man after God's own heart? And then you look at the way he treated his children, I see this kind of permissiveness, almost this prodigious permissiveness that just because I still love them, I'm going to understand the worst things that they do. And so this is God, right? God's grace and God's love is so deep for us, his children, that, you know, whatever we're doing, there's this deep love. So I think parenting really opens your eyes to how love can truly be unconditional. Because otherwise, we just commoditize people. It's hard to really love, to really understand love in a lot of the ways we engage in relationships in our culture.
And I'm doing the math here. So you've got a 9-year-old. So you left the hedge fund, mm-hmm. entered the seminary, and had a child all in the same year.
That's correct.
Roughly around the same time.
The decision had been made before he was born. He was born in February, and I started school that fall. So that we knew that was coming. So that didn't really factor into the decision at that point. But it's, yeah, in terms of life change, that was a big part of it. Yeah.
So we're talking to David Ryder, Minister David Ryder, and let's come back after this only break of the hour, as we continue to talk about his career path, leaving the finance world, a hedge fund. And now we're going to talk about how he ended up in Rochester. He's a Buffalo native, how he came to Rochester, and the work that is happening now at Flower City Church. It is a big career change, and he's been talking about why he's taking it on. If you want to weigh in with any questions or comments, you can do that. You can find me on Twitter, at Evan Dawson. You can email the program, edawson@wxxi.org, or you can call toll-free 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. More with Minister David Ryder next. Coming up in our second hour, the Summer of Food on Connections continues with the discussion about the new restaurant called Fiorella, just celebrated 1 year in business in Rochester's Public Market. We'll talk to the owners, the husband-wife team, who are going to tell us why they wanted to open there, why they wanted to do an Italian restaurant in a market that has a good amount of Italian, and what it really means to do Italian cooking in the United States. It's next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Pastor Ryder says I can just call him Dave.
Yeah, but, absolutely.
You know, I'm going to stick with your full titles, minister or pastor. But that's all right. Maybe sometimes, Dave. You are a Buffalo native, West Seneca?
Yeah.
West Seneca. But after you entered the seminary, you end up eventually coming here. What was the road to Rochester? How did that happen?
Yeah, so out of seminary, there was a congregation in Rochester, just an established congregation that was in the same denomination that the seminary was in, that was looking for a pastor. And so we landed here, and it was kind of funny because, so my wife grew up in Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. and I grew up in West Seneca. So we're both Western New York natives. She, you know, directly from Rochester. But we had, since graduating high school and college, not really lived in Western New York. It had been 20 years, and we were kind of coming back. And so that was a little bit strange, but I remember just coming home and saying, "Hey, you want to move to Rochester?" She kind of looked like, "I guess, yeah."
And when was this?
That was after seminary. It was 2010, and so we've been here 6 years now. I served in that congregation for just about 5 years, and then the call to plant a church, and some things just kind of changed on that end. And so this is my second call in Rochester, still with the same denomination, all the same kind of oversight in terms of the body that oversees the ministers. We're not kind of out on our own, but yeah, it was an opening that was here, and again, that sense of discernment and calling of just like, hey, this is a good fit. This is where we can be. We understand Western New York. We love Western New York. And for me, I'll say Western New York broadly because I hadn't been to Rochester yet, really.
Yep.
And then coming here, I remember looking at Lynn maybe after about 2 years and saying to her, you know, I think I feel more called to Rochester than I do even to this specific congregation. I just love this city and what's going on here, and just felt really at home really quickly and grew roots quickly. And so it's a great place. It's a great city.
So let's
I don't have to tell you that.
Well, no, I'm happy here too. And I'm a Cleveland native. Yeah. But no, I hope this is it for a while anyway, as you do in Flower City Church. You talk about planting.
Yeah.
Talk about calling yourself a planting pastor. What's the term mean?
It means that this church doesn't exist yet. So it's a brand new church, meaning we right now have an outside board that governs us and oversees us. We aren't self-governing. We aren't self-sufficient yet financially. It's a mission. It's a mission church right now that's being planted in the city to serve the needs of Rochester. And so being a planting pastor is kind of like the first pastor of a church that's just coming into formation.
Okay. And what's the timeline like if things go the way you want them to go then?
Well, yeah, we're already behind that. I gave up on that a long time ago. The vision of what would happen has been interesting because things have to shift. And when you're looking at, hey, what do I want to accomplish out of this? Becomes, hey, what work is God doing in the city of Rochester, and how am I being used here, which isn't always the same answer. And so for us right now, we are very happy that we have plugged into some great organizations in Rochester. We have partners, and we're committed from the beginning to finding partners to serve the city with. In other words, we don't think that Rochester's struggling and we're this magic bullet that's going to make all the problems go away. We think there are great organizations in Rochester doing great things. And what we want to do is just come alongside of them, dedicate the resources we have to working with them. And so I know you've had Travis and Christina from Rock City Bottoms on the show.
Yep.
They're neighbors and friends and part of our community. We've partnered with the Center for Youth. Actually, we're going to get an award from them in their annual meeting for our dedication to Rochester's youth, which is a great honor just for such a small organization to be, you know, this is like one of the bedrocks of Rochester not-for-profit. So it's cool to be associated and affiliated with them. And that's what we're doing. We're looking at these organizations that are doing great things and saying, how can we plug in? How can we help? Where can we connect with you? And so we exist for Rochester. We exist for the city. We don't exist for ourselves. It was actually a theologian, William Temple, who said the church is the institution that exists for those who are not members.
Well, I can't help but think, and before I grab another phone call, I can't help but thinking of the juxtaposition of your previous career. Again, if you're just joining us, David worked in finance and worked his way up through a hedge fund. What was the name of that small firm?
Kellner DeLeo.
All right. Your previous career, making very good money, working in a hedge fund, to your life as a pastor, creating this church in Rochester. You mentioned Rock City Bottoms. They were on this program as a grassroots organization doing its part to try to help alleviate poverty. You mentioned the Center for Youth. We've talked to them many times about the work they do for kids, sometimes kids in crisis and trauma. Big, big change. I mean, you're seeing two very different parts of the world in two very different careers, aren't you?
Sure. But I was always engaged in volunteers. I mean, even in my time in Portland, Oregon, which was between undergrad and MBA, I worked for a group called New Avenues for Youth, which was similar to the Center for Youth, where they're just kind of taking kids in crisis and trying to find a new path for them in a better way and a safe place for them to be and redirect. The process was much different, but same type of people and engaging with the same type of clients and trying to help in some of the same ways. So
okay. And so far for you, looking at surveying the city and seeing the work that these organizations are doing and wanting to kind of slide in alongside and partner up and link arms, how do you feel about where Rochester is when it comes to poverty, opportunity? You think about more than half the kids in the city growing up in poverty. Mm-hmm. How does that impact you in the work that you're doing for your church, in your own view as a pastor and as a Christian?
Yeah. So in terms of the work for the church, the first thing is to say, I'll start the other way. As a pastor and a Christian, the first answer to that I look at and say, God suffers with. God suffers alongside of. God comes alongside of and sends his people to go and serve the people that are most in need. This Sunday, we're looking at a passage, the passage where Jesus takes a little child and puts him among his disciples and say, this is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Because humility and looking for the people who are most exploited, because children in that culture were exploited in a dangerous spot and vulnerable and not thought to be worth anything. Those are the places where the church is called to go and to serve. And so I start with, as a pastor and a Christian, that's where I look at, that's what I see when I look at poverty. In terms of where the city is, I mean, there's obviously a lot of work to do in Rochester. The education system is an answer. And when I talk to leaders, I've sat down with different city leaders throughout this and say, hey, what's the issue? And it's interesting, the chicken and the egg thing about, hey, will the schools get better if the poverty is alleviated?
Yeah.
Or will the poverty be alleviated if the schools get better? But those are the two issues that come up when you talk about opportunity. Some of it's educational opportunity. Some of it's a chance to start on that ground. Kids living in poverty whose parents are struggling just to put food on the table don't get the same nurturing and support. And so how do you have, whether it's an after-school program or programs like that, to avoid kids becoming youth in crisis as kids and kind of getting a support structure? So we're looking to plug in any way we can to help people in those situations, for sure.
You want to find them online. They're online where?
It's flowercitychurch.org. And I have to say, we keep saying it, and whenever I speak it orally, I want to be clear, because it's the FLOUR city, and Rochester spells it both ways. So it's flowercitychurch.org.
All right. To the phones we go. Harold in Rochester. Go ahead, Harold.
Yeah, hi. I guess you've already answered a good portion of the goals I think you have for your church, but I have a couple more questions concerning church itself. You've been involved with the corporate America. You've been involved with that. And isn't the church itself a corporation? Isn't that like corpse being the word body, which is corpse? And because of your 501c3 taxes and status, you in itself are a body itself. Is that true?
We are a body. We are not yet organized as a congregation that's self-governing, and so we have an external board in terms of that management. I'm not sure if that's what you're asking.
Well, so are you tax exempt? Do you have the 501c3 tax exempt status?
Operating under the supervision of our classes, yes, we would be tax exempt.
And as a result of that, do you not recognize the head of that corpse or body as the state instead of Christ?
No, I do not.
Well, that's written within the 501c documentation. For you to receive that license and operate as a church, to put the word church on your building or congregation, you have to submit to the authority of the state.
I'm not familiar with that statement, so I can't really speak too much to it, or at least I can't speak intelligently to it. But if you're asking me my view, I absolutely do not recognize the state as the head of the church. I think when the church and state get entangled, it's caused a lot of our problems, and not necessarily from the standpoint of the state. I think it's caused problems for the church. When the church and state get entangled, the church is more likely to be corrupted than the state is to be sanctified. So I don't view the state as the head of the church in any way.
Well, I would definitely examine the 501c3 documentation. You'll see there, written within there, that the head of that body is the state.
The head of our body is Christ.
I certainly would examine it and be separate, as Christ says. And the word church is really a mistranslation. The word truly is ecclesia, or call out assembly. Church, the word church comes from the goddess Circe, which is the same root word of circus.
Well, Harold, thanks for the phone call. I mean, I think there's probably just a...
We could have a long conversation about ecclesia and etymology, but sure.
Well, let me get a different question. This is an email from a listener named Rhett. She says, taking into account, she says, a question for David Ryder, our guest, taking into account your personal history, what would you say to young people thinking about entering the field of finance? What should they consider when making that decision?
Yeah, I'll say one of the things, and maybe this speaks to it in a roundabout way, but I'll get there. One of the things that when I told you I knew that Wall Street might not be where I'd land forever, but I didn't know it would be seminary. One of the things I looked at was the tragedy that I found for middle class folks who are trying to save for retirement. It is extremely difficult for them to get good advice. So if I wasn't going to seminary, one of the things I was thinking about doing was breaking out independently as an investment consulting advisor to people who are not high net worth. The high net worth clientele are so overserviced and middle class America. So to find a way to engage with regular working people, because we no longer have like a pension system. Very few people do. Kind of state employees tend to still do that. But most corporate employees, most private business employees don't have that. They're left to manage their own money. And they're getting charged exorbitant fees for bad advice. And so if there's a way that you can do that, I think that would be a really great way to ethically and morally still participate in the financial world.
In other words, it's not a don't do it. You know, you don't leave that world and think, boy, no one should do that. But it's a different viewpoint. You talk about overservice at the top. High net worth individuals are overserviced because they have high net worth, right?
Well, yeah. If you can take a smaller, it's just math, right? If I charge a smaller percentage of assets and a large pool of assets, I can make more money that way. And so it's easy to serve them.
We're talking to Pastor David Ryder, who is the planting pastor of Flower City Church in Rochester. It just means it doesn't exist yet, but it will. If you have any more questions or comments, we'll try to work in a few more of these. Let me grab Chris and Henrietta next up. Go ahead, Chris.
Hi, David. My question is, my own experience as a Christian has been heavily influenced by Tim Keller, who is a pastor in a church in Manhattan.
Sure. Yeah, I know Tim, PCA.
Yeah, I'm sure you have. I just think one of the most interesting points from one of the things he talks about is just kind of the juxtaposition of Christianity, what Christianity offers versus what, like, a lot of the things, the different institutions of Manhattan would offer, like either Wall Street or media, and just how a lot of people are feeling maybe let down by those things. Maybe Christianity has something to offer them. So I guess I'm just curious, having lived in New York for that time period, to what degree you came into contact with people that might have been feeling that way, or just your own personal experience?
Sure. I mean, I think this speaks, I actually don't think it's a distinctive of New York City or of Wall Street. I think it's more widespread than that in our culture. And what I think the church offers that's countercultural is a notion that begins from acceptance, from deep love and genuine acceptance. And that's where when Evan and I were talking about children, I think that's how parents accept their children. Even, I mean, reasonably good parents, you know, just even average, right? If you're not a parent that's just projecting onto your child everything you want that child to be, that you accept the child for who that child is. And that's what the church has to offer at its best. At its best, when it's following and walking in the way of Christ, the church is a place where people can start from a position of identity in Christ. Now, they'll be called to respond to that in certain ways, but those ways aren't a way to earn something or where I need to validate myself or find self-worth, or I'm going to be defined by if I made money on this deal or if I brought in this client, if you're in sales or whatever else you're doing. And so success or failure, as the world defines success or failure, can drive us, and this is where we mentioned the commoditization of people, where we just kind of chew each other up and we just consume each other. And I think what the church offers is a place where that's not the case, where we start from a stance of acceptance and of love, and then we act in response to that and out of gratitude for that, as opposed to in some kind of an effort to earn approval.
Go ahead there, Chris.
I'm just personally, did you see, like, I don't know, maybe more appetite for like, I guess, what the church is offering in Manhattan? Or, again, maybe you already answered this and it really wasn't that different than, you know, Rochester or anywhere else.
Yeah, I thank you, Chris, for the call. It's an interesting question, David, because I think the stereotype is New York City is not a very religious place.
It's true, but, you know, so Rochester is the 20th most post-Christian city in the country, and New York City is like the top
most
five
post-Christian.
And that's defined as opposed to saying non-Christian place, right, which could be a place that's just never heard the gospel, a place that had a phase where religion was prominent and is now less prominent. And this is like a group called the Barna Group, and they do these kinds of studies. And what's interesting about their study is out of the top 20, Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, Albany, and New York City were five of their top 20 in the country. And some of that's not surprising, right? You hear San Francisco and New York City and Boston, and that doesn't surprise you. But then you're Buffalo, Rochester, Albany, Syracuse are all still on that list with those kinds of cities. And so I don't experience Rochester as a radically different ministry environment than New York from that standpoint, where there's a, and there is, to answer Chris' question, there is a hunger and a thirst, I think, for what the church has to offer, but yet the people wouldn't name it that way. They wouldn't say, I'm hungry for church. I'm hungry for belonging. I'm hungry to be a part of something bigger than myself. I'm hungry to serve the community. I'm hungry for people who really know me and don't just know this one little part of me. And we look at that and say, well, at its best, that's how the church can function, and we can function in a way that we are disciples, which just means learners. Disciples are just a learner from Jesus Christ. So if you find him a compelling figure who's worth learning from, then this is a place where you can do that, even without accepting everything we accept. One
sure.
of our, you know, we're talking about Flower City Church. One of our core values is hospitality to people who are unconvinced about the church's doctrines of Jesus. We want people to know they can belong to our community and participate in all the work we're doing and learn and be a learner about Jesus without necessarily accepting what the church says about him. You can still belong to our community. You can still be a part of what we're doing.
You've talked a lot about acceptance. And here's another stereotype. Modern Christianity is not accepting enough of difference.
Yeah.
It's a little too narrow and a little too judging and casting out instead of accepting. Is that a fair stereotype, and how do you feel about that?
Yeah, so there's only one group of people I will not accept in our congregation, and those are perfect people. There are no perfect people allowed. If you've got it all figured out and you've got all the answers, please don't come. I can't deal with that. I can't live into your expectations of who I should be. So that's the one group I'd say that we're not accepting of. One of the callers mentioned Tim Keller. Tim Keller has a great quote, which I won't get directly, but I'll paraphrase, where he says, you know, if you look at the ministry of Jesus Christ, the people who were drawn to him were the people who were on the margins, spiritually, within the spiritual community, people on the margins economically, people who were out of power, and the most religious and pious people of the day, the rule followers, the moralists of his day, were outraged by him. So if you look at your congregation and it doesn't look like that, you might be preaching a different message than Jesus was preaching.
Got a couple minutes left with David. We mentioned 2007, left the hedge fund for the seminary. I know you have been not only satisfied in that choice, but really fulfilled in the work that you're doing. But how many times have you, and I'm not asking if you wish you could be back and you didn't make this change, but how often do you miss working in the hedge fund?
You know, I've missed it. I've had fewer moments of missing it with each year that's gone by. I was the guy in seminary carrying the Wall Street Journal around and you know, staying in touch with the guys and wondering what bets they were making on the deals and the news I was reading and trying to get a real sense of what was happening behind the scenes. And And I missed it deeply during those 3 years of seminary. I was not, I was not super comfortable with my decision. It had many moments of doubt and wondering if at the end of seminary I'd just go back and just, hey, I gained a bunch of new knowledge about faith and Christianity and church history and all these wonderful things, theology, but I'm going to go back. And I had many moments like that in seminary. But with each passing year of ministry and engaging in the community, and ironically, perhaps with the, or unexpectedly at least, perhaps with the comments that were, the pastoral ministry, the concern that people had, that's one of the things that I've really had a privilege of walking with people.
Well, and we're down to 30 seconds, so if you're wondering, we've had listeners say, hey, you don't give out enough phone numbers or contact information. We want to know more about some of the people who've been on the programs, which is fair enough. So if you're hearing from Pastor Ryder and you feel like you've connected with some of the themes and you want to just learn more or get in touch, how can they get in touch with you?
Definitely flowercitychurch.org. Again, it's F-L-O-U-R, not the O-W-E-R, flowercitychurch.org. And you can email me at dave@flowercitychurch.org and we'll get in touch.
You know, and I will say, you left that world of finance in a position of privilege. You know, you had made a good amount of money. You had the chance to make a big dramatic career change, knowing that you could handle it if you planned for it well. And not everybody who hears this is going to be able to just switch careers if it's not fulfilling them right away. But I think when you talk about trying to figure out what are your values and then looking at your weekly calendar and am I living them enough, not everybody can make a change right away. But you've given us a lot to think about just in terms of that framing. And I really admire you. And I'm glad you reached out and I'm glad we connected. And it's been great talking to you here.
Thank you, Evan. Thanks so much for having me.
Pastor Ryder, good luck with the Flower City Church. Flower City Church, F-L-O-U-R, flowercitychurch.org. More connections next.